Hey, welcome to Guitar Knobs, the guitars, gear, noise, and nonsense podcast, hosted today by these knobs.
Hey, how you doing? It's Todd. I just want to let everybody know, we had so much fun talking about this stuff. We talked a long time. So we're breaking this up into two episodes. Make sure you get all the way to the end, and then listen to the other one. I know, that needed explanation. Anyways, hope you enjoy the podcast.
Tony Dudzik, Pick Guardian.
Oh, sorry. Rob Chafe, Mad Cow Amplification. I didn't know.
Okay.
Hey,
everybody. It's me, Todd Novak. Welcome to the Guitar Knobs Podcast. This is really weird doing it without headphones.
I've got
We are happy. We're thrilled.
Put mine back on.
That you're listening to our show.
Yes, we are.
We've got a really fun one and hopefully a very informative and interesting one.
Yes.
We have two special guests.
Two special guests.
In the room. First of all,
David Kaminga, Grand Poobah.
Yes, Grand Poobah.
Guitar
and,
Knob supporter.
Guitar
yes,
collector,
is.
Aficionado, et cetera, et cetera.
And solar eclipse photographer.
Yes. We also have...
John Fintel.
John
of
Fintel.
Of Relay Recording.
Relay Recording.
Wow, nice.
Yes, you read your card exactly how we set it up for you.
I did.
Ladies
no,
and gentlemen, we
God,
are
no.
going to discuss... things that you should be considering when making your own home studio. You might say, hey, wait a minute, guys. You've already talked about, you know, setting up your house, you know, for playing 101, you know, in case you have a small place or something like that. We've gone through a few things. John, you've been on the show before talking about mm-hmm. So you're going to record 101, but in a proper studio like you run here. Like, what are things that you need? I think this one is specifically so it's you know, we're going to tackle this beyond just playing at home and you need to be quiet or something like that. This is going to be we're going to try to hit a couple different levels of what your recording setup could be, whether that's for recording music, recording content for social or your band or whatever. So yeah, we're going to try to provide as many options and considerations from people. So one of the big reasons here, David just built his own home studio, like a proper one.
I did.
Yes.
I don't know how proper. It's proper to me. It's the most proper I've ever had. But what I did was...
Hold it. Wait. We'll save
that for the show.
No. I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but that's how it's going to go.
Thanks for being a supporter. Now work on the listening part.
That sounded like content. Yeah. Stop that.
And then John is approaching this from a... I actually do this professionally every day, and I think your input is going to be really helpful because a lot of people, when they are considering, well, what do I need? You can basically say, yeah, that's great for home. You don't need to make it pro, but this is how you can maybe meet in the middle, et cetera. We'll see. We'll have scenarios mm-hmm. like that. It's going to be great.
I love scenarios.
Boy,
and Rob
too.
From the Amp World can help us better understand, like, you know, what we need to do. And maybe he'll just be on his phone the whole time. Who knows?
No, he won't.
He's texting me.
He was almost nice for a minute. Almost.
Rob will teach you how to fix all of your home studio equipment.
Yes. No, Rob is a wealth of information and a fantastic guitar player. And he knows a lot about music and guitars and amplification. So that's
and
why
studios.
He's here. And studios, yeah. A little bit.
A little bit.
Well, good, because I am the least informed. Tony knows everything about everything. We still have the warm audio thing going on.
By the time
you hear this, you will have found out that none other than Brian Robison has won the Bender, the warm
Brian.
Bender. Yes, very, very, very exciting. We've got how many more?
That makes five left.
Five more to go, everybody. I feel like the announcer from Willy Wonka. Ladies and gentlemen, there are only five golden tickets left in the world.
Be sure to send your order of preference list in.
Yes.
At the Patreon.
Make sure you do that. All right. John just went in and... he's back. All right, great. Let's find out what's going on in our music worlds this week.
Mm.
Tanya, yes. Go ahead and kick it off, and then we're going to check in with David and John and Rob and then me.
Okay. In that order?
Sure.
Okay.
Probably.
Maybe. So this week I've been doing a big batch of bound guards for archtop guitars. And for those who don't know, it's usually a tortoise guard that has 5-ply binding for the most part. Some are single ply, some are 3-ply binding, but by and large, they're 5-ply.
Are those the small ones that go just under the pickups? And
yeah, like you'd have on a Birdland or on a 355, ES355, or you know, things like that, L5.
When you say 5-ply, are you talking about?
I'm talking about the binding actual on it, binding.
Yeah, okay.
So these are
just to make it clear.
These are binding like you would have binding on the edge of your guitar.
Yes,
and on upscale instruments, archtops. They generally have a bound pick guard. So it's solid tortoise material, 1/8 inch thick or so.
Yes.
And then
no turtles were harmed in making this.
No. It's genuine nitrocellulose.
Yes.
Celluloid nitrate. Hard for me to say.
You want this guy working on your stuff? You can't even say it.
Yeah, another one, bartender. No, but so here's the dilemma. It's not really a dilemma because I guess if you have a $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 guitar, you don't mind spending, you know, close to $300 for a pick guard, because these guards just disintegrate. You know, when I first started,
gas off. Is that the word?
They gas off. Yes,
I've learned a few things here.
And the gas that is emitted eats through first the gold binding on like pickups and all metal parts. Eventually, it'll eat into the actual finish of the guitar, and a lot of people, you know, they're concerned that, well, if I buy another celluloid guard, is the same thing going to happen? And in my opinion, I think probably in 40 or 50 years, yes. I won't be around to worry about that. So, but in probably most
Tony, don't say that.
I'm going to live forever. They're going to save my brain in a jar.
Yes.
But so, I mean, I do have some substitutes that are okay, but I just wanted kind of a roundtable. You guys know guitars pretty well, and I mean, the one option, and especially for people who are opposed to, you know, spending a lot of money on a guard like that, you know, Gibson on their standard line of archtops, they'll use like a 5-ply black material on the pick guards. And I mean, opinions. Do you think that would be, is that okay to put on another?
No.
Okay. He says no. Todd says no.
I says no. If you got a super fancy, like vintage arch top, like that would look weird.
I agree. I mean, but the thing is, I mean, I've done it before, and people have asked about it, and sometimes it's like for an Ibanez arch top.
It's like a Cadillac without white walls, man. Come on.
That's a very good analogy.
Thank
Todd.
You. I'm full of them.
But
you certainly are.
Even if I use a non-celluloid material, like I have an acrylic that I use on some, it's still an expensive process because it's all very labor intensive. Because mm-hmm. you know the way that this works is you cut the center part out, you literally glue the binding onto the outside, you scrape back the binding, you sand the front and the back, you polish the front and polish the front and polish the front and polish the front.
And you're good at that.
How long does it take to make one of those?
From start to finish, I'd like to give it at least 3 to 4 weeks. And that's, you know, that's letting it letting the stuff sit for a while because you have to let the glue set up. You have
if
to let,
you try to tackle that too fast, it's going to fall apart, right?
Well, it'll fall apart. And honestly, because it's the acetone in the binding glue will – it has to settle. It has to harden. Otherwise, you could end up with soft spots.
Yeah. So you need hard acetone.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty lame.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Thank you. Thanks for noticing. But, you know, the other part of it is, and it's really weird, as long as I've been doing this, the same thing happens. You know, you'll polish and buff a guard, and it, you know, it looks great. You come back in the next morning, there's little fine scratches in it. So it's like this, the material has, I don't know, like some hardening process that it requires. And usually when you hit it on the buffer, that increases the heat, and that's what actually helps heal the guard. But I was just, you know, wanting to see, because there are some people, you know, you shoot a price, like, you know, on the low end, it's usually around $225 and can go upwards of $300 for these things.
Wow.
I never knew pit guards were such a process.
But
you know, in this case, they are.
You started this with saying you're talking about most guys doing this are putting them on $5,000, $10,000 vintage pieces.
And I usually don't have problems with that. But what's happening now is even some of the, like the Ibanez George Benson models. Mm-hmm. Those are becoming...
Yeah, that's what probably
expensive guitars.
$3,000.
Yeah, at this point, I mean, when they first came out, they were under $1,000.
They listed for a lot back then. We used to sell them.
So, oh, okay. But and then there's some other ones, and some people want to just dress some of them up, or they buy one that resembles an L5. There were a lot of Japanese guitars that came out in the '60s and '70s that are actually pretty decent arch tops, but some people will just want to upgrade things. But yeah, I every once in a while I do run into a problem where I say, oh my God, I can't spend that much money on it.
And then that's when you offer them your quick, hey, I got a 5-ply, and I can radius and it will look similar, and it's, what, 100 and something bucks or something? Or?
Oh no, I mean, for a 5-ply guard like that, it's 30, 40 bucks.
There you go. And the guys are worried about price. At least for me, I've realized that 2% of the population that complain about price, they're the customer that, no offense to anybody, but I don't really need.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're probably going to be the problematic ones in other ways and everything else. It's like, this is what it costs. It's a reasonable price.
Okay.
All right. Well, over the years, for me, I've learned to just say, I'm buying something that's better quality and I'll pay more for it.
Yep.
Yeah. I just, there's just maybe it's the initial shock where, they're thinking that they're probably, it ought to be $100 or less.
Right. But they're made with love, Tony. That's
the
worth,
pick guard costs more than my guitar.
Exactly.
Well, then,
put a $500 pick guard on a $200 guitar.
Do you make knobs out of that material too?
What's that?
Do you make knobs out of that material too?
I do not.
Okay. So, but it wouldn't require that much polishing, right?
No, I think there are probably some knobs that are made out of that, but we know when you do a lot of knob polishing, they get hot and they they do eventually get shiny.
Right.
Can I say it now? Can I say it? You think it'll hit me?
No.
I'm dying over here.
What podcast is this?
Like Michael Scott on The Office, like.
All right. Well, okay.
If any of the listeners out there have an opinion,
I'm at the kids'
table. What you should and shouldn't
take
do.
My photos.
That was a sub episode, Pit Guards 101.
We did.
Yeah, you did.
We did. We did one time.
It's like a 10-minute episode.
Thanks, Tony.
That's what's happening in my music world this week,
David.
Okay, my music world for the last, as you can imagine, 3 months or so has been heavily involved around just putting together my studio. More about that later, but for now I'll just say one thing I did do back in January. Some friends and I have an annual tradition to go to the guitar show in San Rafael, California. It's the Amigos guitar show.
Yeah.
And we hit the guitar show, and then there's two music shops that are just small independent shops kind of in that area. So we hit them. We usually hit both of those or all three of those. And my friend bought an amplifier at one because he knew they had a vintage, I can't remember what it was right now, but one thing I bought was we went to this music shop in Petaluma, and last year I went there and I bought a mandolin. Well, this year I went in there not knowing if I was going to buy anything, and I told the guy there, I said, hey, last time I was here, I bought a mandolin, and I really liked it, and I said, it was... With a mandolin, you pick it up, and when you play it, within the first 30 seconds, if it's playable and decent. And he asked me, have you ever tried an octave mandolin or a mandocello? And I was like, no. So he walked me over to the corner of the store and handed me an octave mandolin. And as soon as I started playing it, I instantly bonded with it and fell in love with it. So I bought it. But the thing about me is I like my acoustic instruments. Since I play gigs with them, I like to be able to plug them in, amplify them. So I needed a pickup. And so I researched it and I found a pickup that I actually bought two that I'm going to try. And I've tried one now. And that's what I did this last week, was I plugged it into my studio stuff and made a recording with it. And it sounded fantastic.
Cool.
The pickup is the company's Pickup the World. And they're in New England somewhere. It's a small business lady. Mm. really nice, and I put the, you know, I got the Neo mount for it, so I mounted it to the tailpiece. I plugged it into a preamp and recorded it, and it sounded so good. I can already tell it's going to be very
That's great.
Inspiring. And the other thing I did this week was, I would think it was about 4 or 5 months ago, Alex Lifeson came out with a Bitor pedal that I ordered and got, and this week he came out with the Snowdog version, and that's the one that's on its way to me, but I did buy that. Right before I left on my trip, I bought it. So I should probably have it when I get back.
Cool.
To try out.
Fun stuff. I always like getting back and finding packages that have arrived.
Oh, yeah.
That's fun. John? John, what's going on in your music world today?
Well, Todd, this week, let's see, I worked on mixing a song by a band called Summon Luke.
Some and Luke?
Summon.
Summon.
Summon
like
Luke.
To summon, to raise,
yes.
To call forward.
Call toward you, yes.
Yes.
And that's fantastic. What else did I do? I put together...
What kind of music is that?
It's rock, indie rock, alt rock, whatever kind of rock.
Do they have mustaches?
No, and they don't have high-top dress shoes or fedoras or vests.
Cool. Do they
it's
wear
not
hats?
Not that kind. No.
Ah, no. They're not real rockers.
Huh.
Gotta wear a hat.
What kind of hat does a
Anyways,
wear?
Like a, keep like going.
Anyways, keep going. Tony, yeah, yeah. Tony, you told me about Tony before, and I didn't listen. I just don't even look at him. Let's see. I put together pieces. So last week, I recorded two choirs in two prisons.
Two prisons?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was at the Pickaway prison and recorded a choir there, which was about 120 guys, all singing... They were singing the choir parts, mostly the chorus parts, this song called The Journey, and it was all for the Harmony Project.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So the week before that, I recorded the band, the Harmony. I'm it's destroying this story.
It's great so far.
Yeah. So the Harmony Project band came in and did the music tracks, and then I went to the prisons and I took those tracks and played those back, and the inmates sang.
Oh, I was going to ask their parts.
Yeah. Yeah,
so the Harmony Project, the Harmony choir go to the prisons?
No,
or,
this was all inmates.
Okay.
So there were over 100 inmates at the men's prison.
Okay.
And then the next day we went to the women's prison in Marysville and recorded them. They had over 100 people in that choir, and also two lead vocalists. So I had to have a playback system for them, including a monitor so they could hear themselves, which is a whole bunch of gear. And then I took that back to the studio, and
that's not distracting at all.
I know, not at all. I took that back to the studio, put all that stuff together, and made a mix of it. So then it will be a part of a video that is going to be played at Huntington Park for a performance and recording that I'm doing next month.
Yeah, a friend of mine is involved with the Harmony Project, so we try to go to all the shows.
Yeah.
So we're going to that.
It's a cool thing.
Yeah, like it really is.
Yeah, I've been in the prisons. Been there a bunch of times,
so,
you guys.
So, John, I'm assuming to record 100 inmates singing, you use some condenser mics strategically located.
Yep.
How do you keep them from picking up the backing track that...
I don't. So, I do the best that I can do as far as, like, at the men's prison, the playback was behind. The PA was behind where the mics were. Not a lot of bleed at all. That was fine. And then in the women's prison, the way that they wanted them situated for the video, put them at, they were kind of like, the PA was hanging from this gymnasium ceiling, and it was faced toward the mic. So I had to be very careful how those were being pointed. And I was able to get enough of it out that it's not a thing.
Right, so you just minimize it. And
yeah, yeah. Because, and I check the phase and everything.
Right.
Because I don't want that to be
don't
super
phase
weird.
Me, bro.
Right. This guy. So anyway, I mix all those things together and minimize it. So I had both choirs on this piece, and then I'll make a full mix probably tomorrow or Friday.
Oh, so you see the two, the men's and the women's choirs are going to be mixed together.
Yes.
Oh, that's very cool.
And then it'll all be played back, and there'll be segments of this video that feature them. This is a video that's being played back at Huntington Park, which right. is the minor league baseball park here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be an insane recording because there are around 400 or 500 choir members, 29 musicians. There's a string section, a horn section, and a full, like, guitars, drums, bass, keyboards kind of thing.
Sounds like you're going to need some microphones.
Yeah, I'm only providing the musicians that are not the string section or the brass
okay.
or the horns. I mean, so still, you know, it's a big
I've
deal.
Heard we've got some great prospects in the minor league this time.
I have no idea.
Good ad there, Todd.
You like?
Yeah, that was great.
Prospects. Okay.
Are you drunk
John
already?
John just got it.
Are you drunk
Go ahead,
already?
Rob.
Oh, my turn. Okay. What are we talking? What are we doing right now? Music Week.
Oh, don't play like you haven't been sitting here enthralled on everything. Come on.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of blacked out there for a minute. my Music Week. So I've been selling a bunch of guitars lately, and I'm going to sell another one this week. I've sold three Gibson Juniors so far this year. And I'm going to sell a fourth one here.
Wait, what? What's all this?
Yeah.
What do you
explain yourself?
Selling a bunch of juniors. I went so kind of.
Well, all you talk about is these super high end Telecasters. What's all this?
No. If you play back the tape from late last year to early January, I was picking up a junior here, a junior there, and junior everywhere. And I went kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And then I mentioned, I think on the show, maybe like 2 months ago, I said, I got to get rid of a couple of these at least.
How many juniors did you have?
I had five.
Five juniors?
Well, hold on. One proper junior.
I saw the one that Chase did.
Well, that was a special.
Yeah.
And then I had.
And for the record, the difference is two pickups versus one pickup.
Two pickups, yeah. So actually, okay, let me take this back. I had four specials, one junior, all of them kind of oddball things.
Yeah.
Not quite straight. But anyways, so yeah, well, I really like them. So I got five.
Enough to get rid of them.
Yeah, well, and because they were, I had two different specials from the same year that were both two humbucker ones. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, you don't need two of them.
Right. No. I had a SG special.
Yeah,
they had P90s, and I had a later LP special with two P90s in it. And those were very similar too. And the Les Paul one had a huge neck and like 1-inch neck. Mm-hmm. It was just too much. And then I had this actual junior that I'm selling now.
What year?
TV. It's a 2011. TV yellow, but it's a satin TV yellow.
Mm.
So it's kind of weird. It's one of those things they only do 1 year and, you know, it's a special whatever.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so it's time to sell some. So I've sold the blue one. I sold the TV yellow special two pickup 90. Now I'm selling this single pickup junior.
What color is that?
TV yellow. I had two in
How
TV
much?
Yellow.
And it was P90?
Yeah, one was a special with two P90s, and the one I have now that I'm selling is actually not a P90, it's a humbucker, but it's just one humbucker.
Oh, okay.
So it's a little weird, and satin finish, and yeah.
And they're actual P90s, not those P100s, right? Because, like, my special came with P90s, quote unquote, but they're actually called P100s, and they were garbage.
So the P90s that were in the TV yellow special I sold, it was from 2019, were actually 90s. The ones that were in my white SG were actually 100s.
Okay.
I replaced them with Lawlers anyways.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I'm selling another. Yeah.
He still wants to know how much.
I do.
Oh,
I do.
Probably around $1,000-ish is the fair asking price on it. For you, less. I don't know what you use it for.
There you go.
For you, more.
Yeah, 16. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, they're worth somewhere around $1,000-ish is, you know, fair price. Because it's nothing special. It's a satin. I think when they sold new, they went for, well, they suggest retail was like 14 or 15.
Oh.
So, you know, they weren't expensive to begin with. Because
I'm going to sell mine, that 61.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this one has a humbucker in it, though.
Oh, I don't want that, though.
Okay.
I'll put a P90 in it. And you can just fill in that hole with toothpaste.
Well, I suppose you can. You can actually get a Lawler. It's a P90 in a humbucker shape or in a humbucker size.
Perfect. Sold.
Yeah, it looks a little funny, though, because it's still a P90. Anyways, we'll talk about
that. Yeah, you need
I don't care what it looks like.
You're going to do it right.
Yeah, all right. This is all really great. I'm riveted.
Todd, yeah. what about your week?
Thanks, Todd. I'm sorry, we don't have time for Todd's week.
Oh, yeah, we have too many people in the room.
Yeah, we ate up Todd's time.
Todd doesn't do music.
It is a little harder with five in here.
This is an episode.
Would you like me to leave?
It's fun, though. That'll be great.
Would you like me to go?
No. You've already went. It's my turn. Okay, so I got to spend some time with our friend from Sketchy Sounds Pedals, who sent us some really cool stuff. One is the Ruffled Feathers Fixed Wah guitar pedal.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that like a cocked wah?
It's kind of like a cocked wah. Yeah. But it's fixed wah. I had a great time with this. This is really, this is a really good pedal. One of the interesting things on this that I guess for whatever reason I wasn't expecting was actual volume on it. I thought it was just going to be a signal.
Hmm.
Which is important because depending on where you go on it, you actually start to get a little bit of signal loss on the queue, I believe they call it, on the streets.
Do they?
No.
Do they call
and,
it
and
that?
It has a mix knob. Y'all know I love a mix knob, and that was actually super helpful because without that mix knob, then I would be in basically wah pedal land, which I'm not – I struggle with.
That's super cool, though. That you
I struggle with.
Make a little bump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does it. The thing that it does on my Explorer that we put that switch in,
mm-hmm.
it does with the pedal, only more. Mm.
So this is
greater
so
range.
This is a single band EQ, right? If it's mid range and it's got a volume and you control the frequency, plus or minus.
Well, it's like on a wah pedal.
It is, but
on a wah pedal, if you put it not a. Wherever 50% or whatever, you know how you can get that real nasally.
Yeah, it's
tone,
a filtery kind
which
of thing.
Yeah, it's a single band.
Yeah band pass. Yeah, filter.
Okay.
Yeah, and it has
like cool.
It's got an expression out.
That's how an amp guy would explain that.
You can actually turn it into a proper wah if you want to.
By
you mean
bending
it's
over and
you'd have to have some jack
with an amp while you're playing.
Hey, that's a plus too.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's got an expression jack.
See?
Oh, so it makes it.
Rob is not moaning about this.
Hey, that's going to save you in some labor of having to hire somebody to sit down there and turn the little knob.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, right? Trying to do that while you're playing, that would
Yeah, and it's got a really cool graphic on it, which I always appreciate. Also, he sent this really cool
yellow
boost pedal.
It is.
That was handmade, fashioned even, bespoke, if you will, with the guitar knobs. Giant dial.
I'm showing it into
it.
The microphone
yes.
now.
And wow. Guess what, everybody?
Sounds great.
We're going to make a couple more of these, and we're going to have a giveaway. And we're going to give a couple of these away. And
are
there
we
might
eligible?
Be something else coming down the line with that, too. I gotta talk to him a little bit. But anyways, so that was super fun. Got to put together another little board and just, like, say, let me pull this and pull that and jam it all together. And it was great fun. So thank you so much to Sketchy Pedals for sending that our way, and more information on the things that I mentioned coming later. Now, let's get on with our other stuff. Speaking of these pedals, Tony.
Yes, Todd?
If I needed to put these together really quick,
yes,
without any problem.
You would use Tour Gear cables.
That is correct. Thank you, David, Tony, for stepping in where, you know,
weird,
Tony dropped
weird
the ball
middle
here.
Name.
Tony, what if somebody loads up their cart?
Yes.
What is the super exciting
what
part?
What are they loading their cart up with?
With all these cables of different lengths and sizes.
S-shape, C-shape?
S-shape, C-shape, all the stuff.
Okay.
I'll bet you can get a discount.
If you ask nicely and type in the code THEGUITARKNOBS, you'll save an extra 15%.
Incredible.
15%.
Yes, as they say in Montreal. All right. Thank you so much to Tour Gear Designs for sponsoring our four on the floor. Tony!
Let me get a little bit of this!
One, two, three.
Four on the floor.
David, give us your two on the floor.
Okay, for the two plus two on the floor, I'm going to keep the Keeley compressor and the Morley power wah,
because yep,
those are like staples. But I have went back in time, and I now have on my main pedal board a Boss Wah-Zaw Blues Driver.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And the first time I ever played one was at the 2019 NAMM. I played a Gibson Les Paul Classic with P90s, And what they were mainly showing off was their Wausau Craft tube app expander. So they had me plugged into a Marshall. I believe it was a Plexi, but I can't remember exactly now. But I'm playing through this big half stack, 100 watt amp, and it's, you know, at NAMM volume level because of the tube amp expander. But I, as soon as I pushed that Wausau Blues driver, I was like, wow, this sounds great. So I took a picture of it to remember, and then I ended up buying one, and I absolutely love it. It just sounds so good with anything. Sounds good in almost every amp I own, except for I have a Cousin Kettner amp that doesn't like any pedals whatsoever.
Oh.
But any of my other amps that do like pedals, it just gives it a nice overdrive. So that's one of my two on the floor. And my other is going to be a delay. And I have had on my main board for a while now the Walrus Audio Mako Series D1 delay. Mm. And I like it because you could change a lot of the parameters. You can make the delay attack slower. You can make it fade and kind of flange out while it's fading. So you could change it up. And what I do a lot when I play with at my drummer's house, we just do these delay improv jams where I just start playing something with a bunch of repeats, and then he does a bunch of drum effects. And that pedal is always, no matter how I have it set, it's always just been nice and sweet sounding. So that would be my second. Aha. 2+2 on the floor.
Excellent. Very nice. And you didn't sacrifice the other two. I get it.
No.
I get it. Yeah. Okay. John, help fill in this four on the floor with your two.
Two on the
tree.
Two?
No.
I don't
think. Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Two in the... this one is the Empress Para EQ.
Okay.
Which I just got. Bought it for myself for my birthday.
We talked at length about that.
It's fantastic. I love it. I mostly bought it for bass recording. Actually,
really,
yeah, because I want to be able to control a little bit of what I'm doing in the mids. And this thing is parametric, so I can move the frequency, I can change the Q or the bandwidth, and boost it like 15 dB or something. It's insane.
Let me ask
high and low pass filters, Todd.
I know,
and shelving EQ.
We went shopping for
and
this.
A boost.
I remember that.
I know we did.
All these things were very important to you. You just said you use it for bass recording, but you're in a giant studio with a giant, massive, colossus mixing board and all the plugins that you could possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. Tell me why it's important to have that piece of hardware in front of all that.
Because I wanted to be able to control what's going into the bass amp.
Got it.
And... like controlling where the low end is, how low the low end is, and that kind of thing is important. Because what I'm trying to do a lot with the bass recording is I have a flip top and then another Ampeg. It's a V2, which isn't even a bass amp, but I use it as a bass amp a lot and run it through a 15, which turns it into a bass amp, right? But I'm trying to push those things at just the right level to get a little bit of dirt. And if I have too much low end going into it, it'll just blow it out. I won't get the dirt that I want in the mid range. So this is an easier way
and
to control
the low
end.
And that's not something you can
end.
Back off once it hits the board as much.
Not at all, because it'll change how dirty it's getting going to the amp.
Right, okay.
Or how the amp responds to the bass.
Now, you said that's a parametric EQ.
Mm-hmm.
I can see how that would work in Canada and Europe, but does it work okay in the U.S.?
Well played, metric. Tony. I know you were sitting on that for a while. Nice one.
Good Lord.
Because we have the imperial system.
Thank you.
That's what they pay you for,
I
Tony.
I actually bought an Empress compressor
uh-huh.
that I haven't used it yet, but I did buy it.
I like their stuff. So
yeah,
far,
it seems
so
like
good.
It's well built.
Yeah, they're a big deal. They're good.
Yeah. How much was that? Do you recall?
That might have been three something.
Okay.
Because that's the one that has the extra, like the boost.
Yeah,
and
they have
and
the one extra, that doesn't have all that.
Right. Yeah. And cool. It looks just like the Moog EQ4, which is a rack mount gear, like in a pro studio, which is a pretty high-end EQ. And I wonder if there's some sort of relationship. It's the same color. It has the same different colors in the logo that would be the knobs on the Moog.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying, studio people.
Yeah.
This has a lot of knobs.
Yes. What's next there, John?
This is the Stax FX Xenior.
Yes.
Which I got from you, actually.
Yes.
And I love this thing, and it's made it onto my pedal board.
That's a great
pedal.
No
one else can use it. Oh, it's fantastic.
And it's a white on white. It's all whited out special one.
Is this the special one, or is the black and gold one that you have the special one?
They're both special in different ways.
But yours is like, they made it just for my band because everything's black and gold.
Kind of.
Anyway, really. Anyway, this thing does a bunch. It does like a MOSFET. I think it has a germanium setting. It has a couple EQ things. You can scoop the mids or bump the mids with it. One of the coolest things that it does is it has a blend knob. So you can go super dirt destroy and blend in a little bit of the clean stuff so you can still hear the notes. And you can change the, it says drive body, but you can boost like where the distortion is in the frequency spectrum. So you can boost the dirt in the low end or boost the dirt in the high end, which does a lot more than it sounds like it would
do. Yeah, absolutely.
You can just do all kinds of stuff with this thing.
Yeah.
I should get two of them. I need another one so I can just leave this set up on my board and I can stop destroying
my
personal pedal board.
Mm. Yeah.
He knows where you got it. You should ask that guy to give you another one.
I was just going
to
say, Todd, I'd like another one.
Oh, wait, not for me. The guy that made Stax.
And who doesn't love Stax a blend
effects.
Knob?
Stax effects.
I know. Blend knobs are fantastic. All right, guys. Thank you for your four on the floor collectively. That was kind of fun. Sometimes you have to break the mold, you know? All right, we are gathered here today to talk about how to set up your very own home studio for taking your music maybe to the next level beyond just hanging out and playing by, you know, with yourself or with your band or whatever. Stop it, John. So
you make one knob joke. And
one of the reasons that we came to this conclusion is, David, you're visiting, and this was a big deal. You just finished your own studio.
I did, and I'm just now to the little final testing, and I have to actually hook up two more cables. I went all high-end cables for my. I got a rack mount with a 12 unit and an 8 unit down below, and then I got preamps and a rack effects in that.
Right,
and part of the process of that was just figuring out how I wanted to hook it all up and wire it, because it's so complicated. And the one thing that happened was, one of my friends told me, because normally my personality would be to stress out about it and have to sit there and work on it until it's done. But one of my friends, when I told him what I was doing, when I was trying to figure out how to hook all these preamps and effects up, he said, well, that's the fun part. So I just made it fun. And I would get an idea, and you know, the next day I'd go to do it and I'd forget what it was. So I started writing them down in a journal book. I made a Excel spreadsheet that had all the effects listed and where the ins were going and the outs were going, and just figuring out how to route it all. And, you know,
and that's like the icing on the cake, really, because if we step back a few feet.
Yeah, that was the end.
That was the end.
That's where I'm at now.
Yeah. So let's go back to, like, what prompted you to do your own studio? Before you answer that, sorry, we're going to discuss. So, John, you have a full-blown professional studio.
Mm-hmm.
David, you just made a sort of a medium-strength semi-professional studio. And for most of our listeners, we want to make something at home. So we're gonna beg and borrow and steal from things that we've learned from a mid-level studio and a professional studio, and our collective knowledge on gear and how we've done things, and help inform how to apply these things to more of a home studio kind of thing.
And along that line of thinking, I would encourage all of the listeners, if you're a beginner or been playing a long time, whatever point you're at, just do the best with what you have and always strive to improve. A couple examples. During the pandemic, I'm friends with Alan Johannes, who's been on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And we were chatting I've been friends with him for quite a few years, and we were chatting one night, and I had asked him about a specific sound he got. on one of his solo album songs, and he sent me a picture of the microphones he used, and he told me not everything needs to be a Neve console with a Neumann mic. He had a, you know, a $120 Russian mic, condenser mic and a small SE ribbon mic that were, you know, very inexpensive, and he got an incredible sound out of it.
Yeah.
And the other thing that happened during the pandemic, I have a friend, Frankie McCabe, who I did some recording for. I used my $110 MXL ribbon mic to record her vocals, and I sent it to her producer that was making her album. And when he got it, he thought, wow, did you record this? He thought he recorded it, because it just sometimes that low-end gear, if you just use it right, you can get the best you can out of it as you develop and grow. And then when you get to the point, you could build yourself a more complete studio.
Right on. So let's start with what was the first thing that you tried to attack in building out this studio? What was like one of the early considerations?
The very first thing, once I got the layout, because I'm in an unusual space. I'm renting some space from some friends that have an art gallery, and we sectioned off a portion that was going to be for my room, and there's kind of a ceiling obstacle there, and there was like a jog in the wall I had to make for another door. So my room wasn't square or rectangular. It was kind of a funny L shape. But once I saw the room space I was dealing with, I started researching. My first thought was, how am I going to do the sound treatment? That I know is important. I read about it. I didn't know anything about it, except you have bass traps in the corners, you have the reflective stuff, and you got the absorbing stuff. But I had no idea what it needed to be. So I just started reading. I would ask a few people that I knew, hey, what is all this about? And I ended up just coming up with an idea. I used my computer to draw the room map, and then I measured everything and put the dimensions on. And I said, okay, this back wall needs to have some diffusers and some sound absorbing material. The side walls, you have to put some sound absorbing material, and I got diffusers on the right side, but the left side, it goes into that other part of the room, so I just have sound absorbing, and then you have sound absorbing in the back behind the speakers, and then in the corners, you put bass traps, which I was talking to a guy, and I didn't do this, but he said he was in a studio that had cylinders in the corners, so I kind of researched it and saw that was a thing. But then I ended up just getting some of the standard kind that have the little zigzaggy foam, and just like you have in here. And so, and one thing to note is when you research this stuff, and this is something I'll tell, something I discovered, and if my plane crashes on the way home, it's going to be because of this. There's a product. It's called Resilient Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a company that sells it, and they charge like $250 for like eight foot pieces. But I'm in the construction industry, and we use that. I buy pallets of that stuff, and it's only about a dollar something a stick. Mm. So you know you're some of the stuff is going to be outrageous, but that being said, the diffusers I bought or have a shape to them, so you know they're designed to work, and yeah. The bass traps and the sound absorbing panels we had left over from when we did our office remodel. So I just sort of put all this stuff together,
yeah.
And I drew it out on an elevation of my room, and I actually let a couple people look at it. Hey, what do you think? And they said okay, because the main thing what I think I've learned from this, I may be incorrect, but this is what I think, is you want your sound to sound as sterile as possible, because the problem I used to have was, you know, at first when I'd record, I'd put my closed-back Sennheiser headphones on, and I'd record something, and I'd mix it, and it sounded great in those headphones, but in every other system, it sounded crappy because those headphones have too much bass response, they're not neutral. So when you play it on an even system, there's no bass in it to begin with. And that plagued me for years. But
Do you mean sterile or flat?
I mean flat. I use the term sterile because, flat's probably the proper word. But I notice now when I sit in my studio and I play some music over the speakers, it just sounds just clean and sterile. And
you're not getting the reflection off a wall way over there coming back.
Yeah, I'm not getting all those echoes. Yeah. And I did the mirror trick where you have a guy move the mirror along the wall to where you see the speaker. That's where the material needs to be. I did that. I did the same thing on the back. I did the ceiling. I put a piece and I just
let's hold on this here for a second. Let's talk about some of the materials and stuff. So you guys have all had different. I mean, I've got the wall of this behind because otherwise I'd be speaking at a completely flat wall and then we get the bounce back and everything. Now, John, you have many different kinds of different speaking sound diffusers and absorption going on in there. For a non-professional studio, how much of what you have is totally usable in a non-professional studio?
Or how much does a non-professional studio need out of what I have? Well, the corner, the bass absorbers, I think are important. A little bit of diffusion, I think, is important.
And when we're talking about diffusion,
it depends on the room. Depends on the room. What were you asking?
Well, so bass absorbers.
Yeah.
Bass
builds up in corners.
Yeah.
So you need something to absorb it.
Right. But just like when we're talking about materials, the foam stuff that we're used to seeing, the, what is like
Oralex.
Corrugated foam.
They're the big brand Oralex.
Oralex.
And that's what some people just call it. They just call the foam
Oralex. Or if you
Oralex.
Go to Amazon
right,
and you're like,
the
hey,
Kleenex
here's the acoustic square tiles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this... what I'm trying to debunk is the idea that, like, if I'm going to make a studio, everything has to be the tippity-toppity kind of thing, right?
No. There are things that you can do. Does it have to look good? That's the question. And if it doesn't have to look good, there's tons of stuff you can do.
Okay.
Egg curtains.
Do those. Those are not all that effective. I mean, they do a little bit for the high end, which these types of things, here I'm pointing, it's a podcast.
Yeah.
The Oralex little panels that we
these
are talking
just
about.
The sawtooth kind of.
Yep. Those things are great for high end and some of the high mids mostly. Okay. But when you get too low, those things aren't doing much of anything.
Okay.
So you need the corner absorbers. There are other things you can do to absorb some
denser,
of the low
right?
end.
More than anything, they're shaped to go in corners.
Thick. They're shaped to go in corners and they're thicker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the wave is bigger. You need the thicker foam for it to absorb everything. I don't like a dead control room.
Well, and I was gonna say this is different though, and I was gonna say something when Dave was going through this. When to cut you off here, when you're like a guitar player.
Oh, no, wait till you start talking about fixing amps. I'm gonna jump in there.
Now those are the wrong capacitors.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're doing like a project studio where you're tracking your own guitar, your buddy, not so much professional thing. I find usually you do like my last project studio. I had the control room dead. Because I didn't want, because I couldn't treat the room to have it actually be acoustic.
Oh, you couldn't make it
positive.
Like accurate or.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you went full bore.
Exactly. So I just said, let's just kill it. Mm-hmm. So then that way I'm not getting anything weird. Where in a professional setting, you actually want this room to sound a certain way or, I can make this room and I can adjust how it sounds. So I can adjust the frequencies. And
they
you
need
don't
to be flat.
Right.
Well,
when
thing.
I
you
flat.
Can't have any frequency bumps in the room. In my room, I mean, my room is not 100% flat.
Yeah, well, nothing is
darn close.
Can't be perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a small bump, like around 125, but I know that bump is there. Mm-hmm.
And you adjust.
And I just, that's,
I'm
fine with
that. If you're like a typical guitar player, it's like, duh, I don't know really what I'm doing. And your control room is 8 feet by 10 feet. It's like, let's just kill this.
When that came up for me.
Yeah, in that case, for sure.
I first thought I was going to have to put like a carpet on the floor, but in my studies about it, I left my floor is really a really old hardwood, and I left it like that because I want some room, some and then reflection. I didn't treat the over around the corner. I left that just the drywall, and I got a table to work on guitars there and some cabinets. But I wanted to have some room because I know from recording acoustic guitars in rooms, I used to do it in my kitchen because I would get more, because there's more reflective surfaces in there, so you do get some room. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I approached that whole concept of leaving a little bit of liveness in the room.
Yes. I'm going to dip into what Rob was saying because I think, John, this is what we've talked about before, and I think it's worth mentioning again. One of the reasons that we're talking about trying to get the room data neutral isn't as much as it is for better understanding of what your mix is going to do with the other instruments and everything. But when you hand something off, if you record it, so let's assume that the listeners are like, I'm not going to build a mid to pro studio. I want to make something where I can create music, hand it off to and record it well enough to be able to just give it to somebody like yourself, John, who can then master it.
Mix it
and ultimately master it. In doing that, part of the idea of neutralizing a lot of this stuff is why?
Well, like David was saying, it has to be something that's not, you want it like a little bit on the flat side so you can at least have the ability to make it something else, I guess.
Right.
If it goes too far one way with frequencies or whatever, then it's a struggle to get it back to normal, I guess.
So you need something as, I guess, raw as possible.
Yeah.
As flat.
I would say that. Well, kind of flat. Yeah, it has to, I mean, you want to make it sound good. So that's a tough thing. It's like, well, are you talking effects and as far as making it?
I mean, ultimately, you want to lay off a lot of the effects and stuff and do
that. You don't want to go crazy with anything.
Right. Because
chances are whatever you're putting into it with no EQ and no anything is going to be okay in the mix. And it allows me as the mix engineer or whatever to do what I need to do to it.
Right.
If you start like smashing it with compression or EQing the hell out of it, then like if I need to counteract that, that's tough.
Or combating reverbs or tremolos or anything that's modulating.
Right. Unless you have like, this is what I want this track to sound like.
Yeah.
Artistically, this is what it's supposed to sound like.
Sound.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which you then can I want do that. In the actual interface at that point rather than like maybe in the room.
It
with
can be
all
printed, committed or whatever by
like
the person
a compressed
sending
guitar.
It to me.
You can make a really compressed acoustic guitar or like a country western guitar solo where it's just completely compressed.
So, super
spanky.
If they want that, then they can print it and send it to me. And if I can get the uncompressed version as well, then I can do my version of that super spanky thing.
Right.
And that's
So would you say probably you would want it to be given to you as clear as possible.
As clear and just with enough headroom.
I got a question. How often does that
Robert,
happen?
Go ahead.
How often does that happen? You have guys say, hey, I recorded everything and I want you to mix it. And does that happen a lot? Or?
Yeah.
Really? No
yeah,
kidding.
I get sent songs.
That's a really big thing, especially now because people have access to so much more in-home recording equipment. I mean, we're doing a show on how to do that.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, it's weird, but I know, like, four people, that is what they make their living off of.
Wow. See, for me and all the bands and stuff I've done in the past, we've done pre-production where we basically record all of our songs, all the separate parts. So when we go into studio, we're prepared.
But, yeah, that's the most common thing.
Yeah.
And then I get to hear a demo of what they're going
so
for.
So you know what you're going
and
for.
And then it makes the whole process
and we can do
so
it,
much easier.
Do it right, but it like my last band, we never in a million years thought, well, we just wouldn't go to the studio.
You're just like, lay down the accordions. We'll take it into the
Well, I mean, but you take it into a studio that has all the microphones. So if we're going after a certain sound or like we're struggling to get the certain sound, John could go, oh yeah, no, I want to plug you into this and let me turn on the EQ. Yeah. You mean that sound? Yeah. That's what we would have wasted 40 hours getting a bad version.
Well,
of. So that's surprising to me that people are now trying to do everything in house and then just send it out to be mixed. Cause that's going to be hard.
It might not be a try as much as that's
it
what
is,
you got to deal
what
with.
It is.
It is what it's. Yeah. So at some point you say, well, you sent me a flaming turret as a bass track, and guess what? You got
I don't put it like that. Usually if something is so bad, if something is that bad, I'm like, could you like dump some water on that turd for me and send me a new turd?
Or John, would you probably, if that was the case, you would say, hey, can you come in and redo the bass thing in my studio or guitar
thing? That, or if they're out of town, because I do some out of town stuff, then I would just say, can you retrack the bass? Just give me like a DI. Tell me what amp you're using or something. Well, I probably have it here.
When I recorded my friend's, I did about four songs for her, and she had a guy producing it. And the first one I sent him, he called me up and say, hey, Dave, you might want to quit using GarageBand. And I took that as a challenge because I didn't.
What a dick.
I used Logic and I used, you know, what I knew, but the way I recorded it was not. But he had some things he insisted on. But then, like I said, I did send him that next song, and he didn't realize that I recorded the vocal part because it sounded good. But he was like that, where he took what I recorded for her. And then he did the bass, he did the drums, and used.
He played that stuff, right?
He played the bass, and he had a drummer do the drums over on different tracks of what I gave him. That she did the acoustic guitar and electric guitar and sang, and then mixed it out and released her album as the producer. But I have a credit for recording guitars and vocals.
Mm-hmm. So. What I'm getting at more towards, like, we have the luxury of having you close by and we can come in and do that. But a lot of people don't, and they don't have relationships. And it's also like, if I engage somebody to come in for a full recording, it's like, that's a big commitment for time and resources and stuff. And everybody doesn't have that. So a lot of people are, and also you're shopping around, oh, I really like the way that this guy did a mix or a master. And that's what a lot of people are buying into if they are not going in directly to do the recording and having, like, we have you do everything when we record, right? But not everybody has that ability. And you also are able to say, I can send this out to three different guys and get a different mix on that. And then I'm gonna pick the, you know, the guy in the middle or whatever.
Yeah, that's...
I'm just saying that's what people
do. That's a jerk thing to do. Just have like three people. Are you going to pay all three for all those mixes?
No, that's what those guys. That's what their industry is doing. That's when they're saying, "Yes, send me your mix. I'll give you an idea. And if you want to go with me, cool. It's that much."
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, more. That's just another thing. Just go investigate that yourselves, people. Okay. We're going down a different kind of rabbit hole.
So we're talking about treatment.
Talking about treatment and stuff. So
killing a room, not killing
right. So things to look out for. If you are in your own basement or you're an apartment or whatever, what are things in the apartment or basement that we should be mindful of?
Rats.
Windows. I'm assuming you want to like.
I would say like the, well, you can't really change the dimensions of the room.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You can't change dimensions.
Where you put stuff in the room does matter.
Mm-hmm. So you don't want to put the desk with the monitors in the corner, right?
Well, I looked it up and I read somewhere, I think Oralex's website, somebody had a thing that told me the optimum spot for your listening position is 38% of the depth of the room. So I actually measured 38% and I put a piece of gaffer tape on the floor with a plus on it.
And you built it around that?
And that's where I know, and that tape is still there. So I know when I'm there and I put my speakers in an equilateral triangle, 4 feet from my ear to that speaker, 4 feet from my ear to that speaker, and the speaker cones are 4 feet apart.
Yeah.
And I did that just from my learning. That's what I figured out to do, and that's what I did. Of course, I wish my room were bigger. It's a small room, but I have what I have to work with, so that's just what I did, and I think it's going to work out just fine.
Now, and if you don't have the ability to, like, say you're in an apartment or a condo or something, and you can't have those flat speakers, neutral speakers, flat response speakers, whatever, then you're down to probably some headphones, right?
Yeah, and if you do for tracking, you can use closed back headphones because they won't have any bleed. Mm-hmm. But for mixing, you want to use open back. That way you're getting less bass response. And also, another thing that I actually just did this week was I took my reference mic and I used the Room EQ Wizard. And, you know, I think from what I did, I bought some speakers that they're not expensive. I got some Collies and I got some IK Multimedia iLouds. And I have them both set up. And what I did was because I'm so used to having horrible sound, it's just the bass was off and all that. So what I did was I put my reference mic and I did the Room EQ Wizard and I saw the curve of the speakers and the room. And then I plugged in, I have this Behringer Ultra Curve that I've had for years, but I've never used it for this, but I plugged the reference mic into the back and you go on and push the buttons on it and it'll generate white noise. And then that will, the mic picks it up and it makes a custom EQ curve for your speakers and your room and it flattens it out. And then you go back to the Room EQ Wizard and that tells you what your frequency response is. And when I did it on that second pair of monitors that aren't as good as the ones, that one had a high at between 10 and 15K. And so I went into the EQ curve it made and I lowered that value and I did it again and it was flatter, so I saved it. So now whenever I use those monitors, I make sure I use that EQ in my monitor signal chain, and as far as I know, that's making them sound neutral.
So are you running your that like all of your mixes and everything are going through the Behringer thing before going to your speakers on everything?
Yes. Yeah. What I have is I have I have my audio interface. I have a Universal Audio Apollo Twin X, and I have the monitor outs going into the Behringer Ultra Curve, and then that goes out into the, I have a big knob Mackie that's just neutral to control which monitors I use. Mm-hmm. And separately, I have from the Ultra Curve, I have the auxiliary outs going over to another rack that I have a headphone amp and a Tascam memory recorder. So if I ever have people come over to play with me, we can use headphones through that. And I don't think the sound is as crucial then. Mm-hmm. But I think the using the Ultra Curve right before the monitors was an idea I came up with to try to make sure that the sound I'm getting from those is neutral.
Mm. And I mean, I'll chime in there. I had a studio, you know, 25 years ago that was
ADAT.
Well, actually, it was right after ADAT.
DA-88.
What was I running? I think I was running Pro Tools.
HDR-24 or something.
I was running Pro Tools, but this was before. I still, it was right at the crossroad because I had a MasterLink. Remember those?
Oh yeah,
mastering thing. Yeah. Yep. But anyways, but I didn't have a whole ton of money. I was like 25 working at a music store, but I had the Elesis package, for lack of better terms. Mm-hmm. I had the Elesis 3630 compressor.
Yep.
Their graphic EQ, their monitors. Uh-huh. So monitors, I mean, for whatever they were, $300 for a pair, they were okay. But without that EQ, they were terribly annoying because they had some horrible peaks and horrible values. And I white noise, well, like he was talking about, where my reference point. The downside, I don't know if you ever had to do that, but if you EQ your monitors for a reference point, you move over here and it changes pretty darn drastically. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well,
so does that make it okay to do your mixes like that at your reference point?
I found it was better when those speakers were so far, had such peaks and valleys. I found it was better, but I would often toggle it on and off and go listen to it somewhere else. I mean, my opinion, you're correcting something that isn't perfect. That can be good. Your better
those
option.
Monitor ones, is that what those were called?
Yeah, the Elesis
monitor
ones.
Yeah.
Monitor ones.
Yeah, that's what we had at the second studio I worked at before I built my own place. Were
did
like
you
a
notice
set of
the
those.
Weird? It was like 8K or 10K that was like really obtrusive in those.
A little bit.
I sure did. So, anyways, if you've got speakers,
yeah.
That's great. If you don't, get yourself some. David, I like your idea of having, you know, being able to have closed back and open back The logic that you shared, I think, probably makes sense.
And you can't be cheap. If you're going to mix on those things, don't be cheap on those headphones.
You got to get a good pair of open back.
And if we're talking about somebody like doing something in their house in the basement, you know, by themselves, maybe rather even than buying monitors and waste the money trying to EQ them and everything, maybe just put your
headphones
into a really good set of headphones.
I tell you what,
I
know that the Grado company out of, I believe they're in Brooklyn, but we've been using their open back headphones, and they have several levels of
Grado.
Okay.
Or Grado.
I've been calling them Grado. Whatever.
Grado.
Grado.
Is there an E in there?
No. Grado.
Yeah, that's not Grado.
Well, Grado would be two D's. So thanks, everybody.
But way more
anyways,
fun.
Grado, whatever you want to call it. They're handmade in the USA, and they're pretty solid. You know, to check out.
Which
there's lots of other ones that you can, of course.
That's what I was going to ask, John. If you had your money and was going to just buy one set of headphones to use for tracking and try and do mix, what would they be?
Boy, I don't know.
Because I have a close back.
No, I have a sure. I don't remember what the number is.
What do you use when you're recording out in the field?
I use very high-end earbuds because I don't like headphones on when I'm in the field.
Okay, so tell us what those are.
I don't know. They're sure like 215s or something.
Who invited him?
Another thing, though, if you got them on Amazon, $10. If they're going to go with the in-ear monitor
system,
then one of the key things I learned about those is you get like a 2-driver or a 3-driver because they're going to sound clearer than just the ones that come with your phone are going to sound
clearer. The last ones I had, I think it was... 1, 2, 3. It was a 4-drive or 5-drive. It had 2 lows and then high and 2 mids. So I think it's 5. Yeah.
That's great.
It's ridiculous.
You could get a mini driver too. She was great in
fit your ear better.
What?
She really
I loved
fit
her.
Your ear.
Yeah, she was great in Gross Point Blank.
She really was.
Okay, so get yourself a good pair of headphones, but I think the key thing that we're all trying to say is don't get something that has massive bass response.
Do not, Beats.
Yeah, stay away from Beats. Things. Stay away from anything that you're going to listen to your favorite hip hop record on and be like, "This is amazing."
That's the number one tip right there. Don't get headphones that are too much bass.
Yeah,
because it might be good if you're listening to process music while you're riding the bus or the plane.
Yeah,
but for doing this, you can't have that.
Well, anything that's too hyped in any frequency is going to screw you when it comes to people listening on other systems.
Indeed. Okay. Moving on, let's see what some other elements are. We've talked about.
I feel like I'm on a game show now. Indeed,
it's this is no game, John. This is our live.
I'll
take next topic for 4,000.
Yeah.
So we're talking about recording. Are we just assuming everybody's going to be going to a PC? I mean, do they even make multi-track standalone recorders now?
We're about to get to that.
Yeah.
So
I can talk about that too.
Which is your Colossus, Titan, Gemini? Uh-huh. What is that thing called?
What?
Your big mixer in there.
Oh, it's a Trident.
Trident.
ADB.
ADB. How many is that? 68 tracks?
It's 32.
32.
The 24.
Okay. And then David, what did you get?
So I have a...
The elevator version.
Well, what I use is I use my Mac Studio computer.
Yeah.
And I have a Focusrite 8 Pre, which is 18-20, I think is the official name for it. It has 10 outs and 8 ins. And then I also have the Octopre that goes with it. But then I use a Universal Audio Apollo Twin X.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just talking about your actual... You got a board, right?
Well, I have those.
Okay.
But he's using...
They're probably not integrated in your studio.
Yes. And what I do is I use my Mac Studio and I plug both interface. I use the ADAT fiber optic light pipe to take the channels out of the Octopre into the other interface, and then I use the USB of that, and then I use the Thunderbolt from the Universal Audio into my Mac, and I set up what they call an aggregate device that uses both of them. And it's very... I've never had any problems with it whatsoever. It's worked fine, but the hardest part is to map all the channels, because you might see... three or four inputs on something, but it's got all these virtual inputs and ADATs and SPDIFs, all this stuff. So what you have to do is you have to take the time and set your I/O labels. So now I've labeled every input that I use, I've labeled with what it is. So that way when I'm setting up a new track, I know, but I don't have a physical mixer in
he's
my studio.
It's a virtual mixer, is what he's using.
Right, but I do. But I do have a Tascam 24 track recorder that I bought because I wanted to buy it. I used it a little bit. I want to use it, but I use the other stuff. Yeah.
So in yes.
Well, I was going to say. I think. I mean, and what David's doing is not your typical guy.
He's mid-level.
It. He's definitely mid-level.
Yeah.
Because I would imagine most listeners say, I want to get a little studio together. They're going to use one interface.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about.
Right, right, right. And so, because, I mean, like, as you're talking about, that's awesome. Right. I used to have something similar with two interfaces.
But I learned how to do that because I was recording my band.
Right.
And my drummer has every drum mic'd.
Right.
And I got all those channels. I was able to record 24 tracks simultaneous. You know, I had a girl in my band that played acoustic guitar, played sax, she sang, played flute, had another guitar player and had a bass player, and then I had 10 drum mics coming my way. And then we all had talking mics.
Now, let me ask you that I'm just gonna ask you this. Why didn't you go with like an X32 or something rather than several different interfaces?
I don't know.
Okay.
Fair enough. I didn't go buy them all at once.
Ah, okay. That's so it was like you already had some stuff and you're like, let's add
so
to
what
it.
So okay. The last one I did.
It's also more economical to do it the way you did it because you probably have a couple mic pre's and converters that are fantastic, right? The Apollos.
Yeah.
And how often are you recording full band stuff? You don't need to have the most expensive for that last eight channels that you're going to use on a rare occasion,
about that,
you know?
I ended up getting rid of an eight channel Modos Mark of the Unicorn input, and when I got my last Allen Heath digital rack mount thing, because that's 16 ins plus four stereo and eight outs, and I realized I could just plug in a USB 3 and it would talk both ways with all that in and out. So I was like, well, I don't need the Modo anymore, and that was only $1,000. That little Allen Heath digital thing.
Yeah, right. Well, if you don't have only $1,000, let's talk about some other options.
That's pretty cheap for an interface nowadays.
Yeah, so anyways, when we're talking about some of those options, so we've got mid-level, we've got...
But I also have an AXE-IO, and I have a Presonus 2-channel, stuff that's only a couple hundred dollars.
Let me cover a couple of those.
Yeah.
Here we go. So we're checking out with the we went to Guitar World and we said, hey, you know, let's look into this a little bit. And they've got a great list. It says a quick list, and this is the 2024 top picks for every budget for audio interfaces. Okay, so this is going from in between your computer and whatever you're putting into it, right? And this is
that's very tech savvy there.
Well, I have to cover all.
What's
bases.
An interface? It goes between your computer and whatever you're putting into it.
Yeah. I kind of like you're going this direction because we are talking to people that are at a beginner level.
Yeah.
Maybe a lower budget. We should help that part of the community.
Absolutely.
Also.
So best for your budget. They're stating the Audient ID4. MK2. I know that's a mouthful, but just look up Audient. And so there's the interface on this actually looks really cool and it looks very easy to use. The one they say best four input. So and now we're talking about more than just one of your guitars. So remember, we're at home and we're at a beginner level studio.
Right, but I could see. So when I first started doing this, one of the things I first did was when I recorded my acoustic guitar when I wrote songs, I would use three or four microphones at a time.
Sure.
And I would put a condenser mic pointed at the 12th fret. Then I'd put one down below the body, and then I'd put two room mics and I'd try to get some of that ambience thing. So I could see somebody getting a four input.
Yeah, and if you're like, hey, I like this model, but I want more, most of these brands have, a lot of these brands have expanded units. Mm-hmm. The Focusrite, Scarlett, everybody, I mean, that's a super familiar one. works excellent. They've got 2, 4, and then it jumps to 8, I believe. I thought this was interesting. This is best for bass. We got a lot of bass players listen to us.
What is it? Tell me.
Yeah. Why,
it's the Universal Audio Volt.
Best for bass.
Best for bass, is it like a dumbed down version for bass players? Is that what it is?
Wow. Actually, the best
what
for bass.
What would make it best for bass?
Everything I've ever said about Rob just
and actually, I think the bass one can probably cost more since they save money on strings.
Yeah.
That's right.
So anyways, that bass players disregard all these animals in
but
here.
But seriously, what would optimize it for bass use?
I don't know. I'm trusting that Guitar World has spent a little bit of time figuring this out. John doesn't have anything to say about that, so whatever. Okay. Do with that with what you will.
Yeah, I have a Universal Audio Volt also. That's a nice one.
How does it work on bass? How does it work on bass?
I actually own 2 basses, but I have yet to...
your next assignment.
Yeah, I was going to say, get on that.
I have not used that one, but I have recorded with the basses and... Yeah. You know, yeah. I'm not much of a bass player.
But if
player,
you're not using the
we're
volt,
have a
then you're not doing it right.
That's right. I'm going to have to go back and change them. That's why they sound so bad.
So what else you got there? Universal Audio Focusrite?
By the way, the Universal Audio Volt 176 features a built-in compressor that helps tame the low end.
It an 1176.
Yeah. So then it says best for Mac, the UA Apollo Twin. We've just been discussing the Apollo.
That's great.
That's a nice unit.
Really if you unit. Can afford those, that's a good one. It's just a little bit spendy.
Like a grand?
Yeah, I think they're about a grand. I paid like.
I feel like we've learned you can do a lot with a grand.
I think
today.
I bought mine for $800 about 4 years ago.
Yeah, and I would say
$999.
This is one of those things. Don't cheap out on probably the most important piece of this puzzle here, the interface, the converters.
That's absolutely true.
Especially and if then it has also, a preamp in it. If it has a preamp in it, that's super important.
Yeah, and it has. They have the plugins that have all the good Unison preamp things that you can actually, they say it emulates you're actually using like
hardware.
Oh,
you mean they include plugins when you buy it?
There's
you get a handful.
Plugins,
yeah. But, but yes.
So, now, these are a couple interfaces. We've talked, there's loads more, so just go check that out. But I think another thing that we are starting to see a lot more of is I'm not going to actually mic anything. Okay? So, if you are living in an area, where you're living in a room or whatever, where you're just like, I can't mic stuff. Fortunately, there's loads out there for you to be able to record and go actually directly in from a unit. We've actually had a couple on the show. What are those, Todd? Well, let me tell you.
We're all like, we are.
So we had Blackstar on.
Oh, yeah.
And they've got the Amped 1, the Amped 2, and the Amped. All right, that was part one of our super long episode. And make sure you check out part two coming right after this.
Well, that's it for these knobs. Please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/theguitarknobs. Visit our website at theguitarknobs.com for all of our past episodes, 4 on the Floor blog, and other good stuff. You can connect with us on social too at our Facebook page. And share your gear and stories on our Facebook group. Also, be sure to check out our Instagram @GuitarKnobs. Catch you next time.